Much is sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading from Hayti Police, Memoirs of a Former Durham Police Officer, by Marshall Thompson, written in 1997. Continuing with Chapter 3. It was Officer J.W. Price who found out, by accident, around 1963, that the blacks were called the Hayti Police. Price received a prowler call one night in the exclusive area of Forest Hills. When he arrived at the scene of the prowler call, a doctor's home, the doctor came to the front door and said to Price, "Thanks for coming." The doctor said, "Officer, after you complete your call regarding the prowler, will you come to the front door? I have a question for you." Price replied, "Sure." He didn't find a prowler, so he went back to see the doctor. The doctor stated that he had called the police 4 or 5 times before the dispatcher replied, "All we have available is the Hayti Police." The doctor replied, "Send them, then." The doctor asked, "What the hell is a Hayti Police?" Price explained to him that they were the Negro officers that worked in Hayti. The doctor replied that he didn't give a damn who they were. When he called the police, he wanted the police. Forest Hills borders the St. Teresa community, another black development near a white community. Only some trees and a railroad track separates these two areas. St. Teresa had the dirt streets. In 1965, J.L. Price was the first black police officer to work on the traffic division in downtown Durham. He became so popular at this activity that the white merchants showered him with gifts during Christmas. In 1973, then-Sergeant J.W. Price was a sergeant in the Identification Bureau during the John Hunter shooting and the homicide of Amos Wilson. His role, however, was not that significant in the case. The fact that John shot Amos was never in dispute. It's why he did it. That still mystifies the public to this day. The official story of why John shot Amos is that John was so drunk that he thought that Amos was a prisoner who was trying to escape. A superior court judge terminated Officer Hunter, placed him on probation forever, and made him pay the Wilson family a lot of money to compensate for the loss of Amos being the breadwinner in his family. It's amazing the things that you can learn as a police officer. Remember I said that a superior court judge, or big court judge to the police, fired J.E. Hunter. A superior court judge has that right. The ranking officers on the police department, of course, knew of the superior court's power and discretion. The chief at the time, Chief Pleasance, knew what was going to happen. So he didn't have to fire John. He allowed the court to do what he had tried to do to John several times before. Chief Pleasance didn't particularly like John, because though he knew that John worked hard, he also spoke what was on his mind. Once, when a black officer named Allen was promoted to detective, John was in a toilet stall in police quarters at 2014 North Mangum Street. This was in 1965. Another officer, whose name I don't recall, was reporting to John about Allen's promotion. John said, as a result, "It's not what you know, but who you blow." The chief, unbeknownst to John, was in the next stall. Chief Pleasance asked Hunter, "What do you mean by that?" John replied to the chief, "If the shoe fits, wear it." Chief Pleasance responded angrily, "As long as I'm chief, you will never be promoted." And John wasn't. The vice squad was the closest thing to a promotion that Hunter ever had. Unfortunately, he was 41 years old when he came into the vice squad, which is a whole new world from a uniform officer. It's a young, aggressive officer's job. Ironically enough, I was on the vice squad before Hunter came aboard. It was left to me to train John in vice work, whereas he had been my main training officer in uniform patrol. I had been on the vice squad for 6 months when Lieutenant Lee asked John and I, in August of 71, which one of us was interested in staying. I never understood why only one black could be on the vice squad at one time. It would have been better for all concerned that John and I had stayed together. In August of 71, there were 30 arrests made by the vice squad. John and I made 28 of them. I was taken off the vice squad, and John was there alone. John Hunter remained the lone black officer on the vice squad. He did okay, except that his drinking problem became worse. Consequently, it resulted in the homicide of his friend Amos. My career took a turn for the best, then for the worst, and then ended in good order. I became the first black uniform officer to work in an all-white neighborhood. My good reputation, without scandal at this time, along with my military experience, that's 2 times to Vietnam, my educational background, Hillside High School class of 63 and Durham Technical School class of 71, held me in good standing. I was married and buying a home as early as 1968 at the age of 23. But things can happen quickly on a fast-paced profession as the police. As a young recruit in August of 68, my training captain, Captain Rosemond, stated to my recruit class, "Gentlemen," he said to all 16 of us, "there are 3 things that will get you away from here quicker than anything. They're liquor, women, and or debt." Illegal drugs weren't prevalent at the time, nor were there women on the police department in Durham in 1968. Captain Rosemond was right. In all, I spent 19 years and 2 months on the Durham Police Department. At least 400 men and a few women left the force during my tenure on the force. Over half left for reasons described by Captain Rosemond. Drugs have to be included now, as well as women police who have trouble with their men. Thank God that there are always good men and women who are always willing to join the force to replace those that leave. Thank God for those who remain and stay good officers to the end, no matter what transpires around them. I believe in the old saying that rough times don't last, but tough people do. The first 2 women came on the force in 1973. They were both black. They left for varying reasons. The 3rd one, also a black female, is now one of the highest-ranking females in the country, Major Glenda Beard. A police officer must be tough enough, and I don't mean physically, to weather any storm that comes his or her way. Only the strong do survive, they say. Once you continue to survive, you may get some living done. You don't have to be macho to be a police officer. It's like Mae West once said, "Macho ain't mucho." I can't count the machos who had to leave the force unwillingly. On the other hand, when I came on the police department, August 1, 1968, I had a 29-inch waist and weighed 156 pounds soaking wet. Veteran officers, black and white, told me that I would never make it because I was too small at 5'9", too easygoing, too polite, and too soft-spoken. They only measured the outside, but not my inside. After 4 years in the Marines and nothing but hard work all my life, the police department was easy. During the 19 years that I was on the force, I made 5,000 arrests and only had to use my nightstick 3 times. 2 of those times were in defense of other officers. That is why I know that the Rodney King incident was very unnecessary. It may take 100 officers to bring someone under control, but none of them have to strike the person, unless, of course, the arresting officer's lives are at stake and self-defense becomes necessary. Unfortunately, black as well as white officers have used unnecessary force many times. I left the Durham Police Department October 1, 1987, on disability retirement, blindness in my left eye from glaucoma. Most of my cohorts, black and white, that came before me were not so lucky. The average time on the police department for all police was 5 years. They mostly left because of liquor, women, and debt, or a combination thereof. For John, it was the heavy drinking of this otherwise fine officer that did him in. He died of a heart attack while in a taxi heading north on Fayetteville Street near Pilot Street. He was only 48 years old when that happened, in 1978. P.W. Kennedy, Another Hayti policeman and I led John's funeral from Oak Grove Free Will Baptist Church on Colfax Street to Glenwood Cemetery. It was not a large funeral procession, mostly family and a few friends. Very few police attended. If J.E. Hunter had died in the line of duty for any reason before February 13, 1973, half of the North Carolina Highway Patrol would have been requested to help with the traffic. A bitter lesson can be learned from this and other similar incidents. When you're on top, everyone loves you. When you get in trouble, you're in trouble by yourself. I prefer the story that used to be told in Texas about a conversation Jim Bowie and Sam Houston had before the Alamo took Bowie. The story goes, Jim Bowie, Sam, do you remember when we first came to Texas years ago and I got in a fight with those two fellows in this saloon? Sam Houston, sure, Jim, I remember. Well, Sam, why didn't you help me? Because, Jim, you were wrong. Sam, that's when I needed a friend. I'm reminded from this story that America always backs England and Israel, even if they're wrong. It may not sound right to do this, but blood, I'm told, is thicker than mud. We all need someone to depend on when the going gets tough. I have a saying that goes, the buck of life stops at two places, depending on which comes first, the graveyard or the courthouse. Of course, even if you die first, your property can go to probate court. The first part of 1973, from January until late July, was not too bad for me, personally. From the middle of July until the end of the year, though, was total hell. I had gotten in trouble with a beautiful white female in a totally white section of town. Admittedly, the powers to be on the force had enough information to suspend me. But no, they wanted to hang me from the highest tree in Durham. I could not allow that. I retained attorney Mickey Michaud as my attorney, and together we fought the power structure up to the city manager level, and consequently I was reinstated on the force after being suspended for a month. Thank God for Mickey Michaud, now a state legislator. My chance for promotion after this incident was slim and none. Fortunately, I had already enrolled in North Carolina Central University during the summer of 72. Being in school is a great way to keep your mind occupied on positive living. Besides, it can only help in the long run. The sacrifice of working and going to school can only be understood by those persons who've done the same. Here at the end of Chapter 3 is a copy of the obituary for John E. Hunter. John Ernest Hunter of 519 Uzzle Street died Friday night while he was en route to the Veterans Hospital. Hunter, an Army veteran, had served 19 years on the Durham Police Force. At the time of his death, he was employed at Research Triangle Park. He was a former member of the North State Law Enforcement Association and the Vanguard Club, Incorporated. A funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Tuesday at Oak Grove Free Baptist Church by the Reverend Z.D. Harris. Burial will be in Glenview Memorial Park. Surviving are his wife, Mrs. Litty Hunter, a son, Specialist 4th Class Kenneth R. Hunter of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, a daughter, Miss Angela Hunter of the home, a brother, James T. Hunter of Baltimore, Maryland, and a granddaughter. Chapter 4. When Officer Gerald Parrish and I were working together during the mid-1980s, he told me that when he got the death call, a man in a taxi, at Fayetteville and Pilot Street, when he arrived at the scene, he didn't know and hadn't even heard of J.E. Hunter. Naturally, it came as a shock to Officer Parrish to discover that Hunter was a famous police officer. Officer Parrish is a caring and sensitive officer. His statement to me that he didn't know who the deceased was placed a seed in my mind that a whole generation of new officers, and in particular, my concern for the young black ones, must have an identity with their past. It's the same to me as the fact that some of the black baseball players aren't really aware of the achievement of Jackie Robinson, or much worse, don't care. My experience with black police officers started when I was 10 years old, in 1955. In the late spring of that year, there was a terrible lightning and thunderstorm one night. At this time, my family was living on Park Lane in the Pearsontown section of South Durham. Park Lane is now Atlantic Street. Park Lane ended at railroad tracks and continued as a path running parallel with the tracks until the path ended at Fayetteville Street. We lived in a typical shotgun house where one could see from the front to the back door. The outhouse was in the backyard. Atlantic Street is now very upscale and modern. During this thunderstorm, I observed a lady we called Little Bit, because someone had bitten her nose off during a fight years before, walking south on Park Lane with a man that I didn't know. Even though it was raining, lightning, and thundering, I could hear them arguing as they walked. There were several liquor houses in the area that they were headed to. I'm sure that Little Bit was headed to one of them. The next day, my next-door neighbor, who was a year or two younger than I, was playing cowboys and Indians on the embankment and pathway on Park Lane. We had been jumping over this large bundle of rags at the bottom of the embankment when all of a sudden I observed some hair at one end of the clothes. Then, believe it or not, I noticed two small holes where there should have been a nose. It was Little Bit. She was obviously dead. Now, at this time, the only death that I had known was my maternal grandmother, who died when I was 5, when she was lying in state in our house that we owned on Nebo Street, another part of Pearsontown. I asked my mother, "Mama, are you afraid of dead people?" Mama replied, "It's the living that you have to worry about, not the dead." We ran to Otha's house and told his mother. She called the police. Otha had to stay home, so ordered by his mother. My mother and father were not so strict. Otha is now an engineer somewhere in Colorado. His father died in an accident. My mother and father died of natural causes in 1975 and 1984, respectively. It was not long before a uniform officer arrived at the scene. He was well-tailored and very professional. He asked me a few questions after observing Little Bit. I told him how we found her. The officer, I don't remember who he was, called for the detectives. Soon, two black detectives arrived. I found out that the tall, dark-skinned one with the glasses was Clyde Cox. The one about 5'10", 190 pounds, was Frank McRae. They both wore wide fedora hats and double-breasted suits. The mud in the area didn't seem to get on them at all. It was discovered later that Little Bit had received a broken neck from a fall down the embankment to the bottom of the hill. The man that had been with her was picked up, questioned, and released. It could not be proven that he may have pushed her, because her blood was full of alcohol. I still couldn't but wonder years since then. I saw this man walking back up Park Lane in an angry manner later on that previous night during the storm. He was alone. At this point in my life, I was more concerned about how many Indians that I could kill, or, as Tarzan, how many natives I could swoop down on. Most of the black kids in Durham observed these killing events taking place at the Regal or Booker T. Theaters on Pettigrew Street in Hayti. That's where kids from all the black neighborhoods converged every Saturday morning for 9, then 10 cents in my time, to be babysat by the movies. Life was great for a poor kid during this time. Looking back to that time, the word poor never crossed our lips. Being a police officer wasn't much to think about either. We saw police in person and up close, but rarely did we see a black officer on the big screen. If it was not at the Regal or Booker T, it must not be real. The Regal Theater was at that time 35 cents for adults and 10 cents for children. I believe the Booker T costs a little more because the more sophisticated or sedate crowd met there with their dates in the late evenings. Before my time, I understand, there was a third movie theater called The Wonderland. It was at these theaters, during talent shows, that the famous comedian Pig Meat Markham, who is from Durham, got his start. Clyde McFatter and other singers began here also. Speaking of Clyde McFatter, I met him in the summer of 1960 on Pettigrew Street. My sister, Irene, who was an entertainment groupie, came to me while I was shining shoes on Pettigrew Street for Jerome Harris's shoeshine stand. Irene said, "Marshall, come with me. I want you to meet someone. He's a famous singer." We walked toward the Biltmore Hotel, where Clyde McFatter was parked outside in a fancy-looking car. He had processed hair and was leaning his head out the passenger side of the car, a blue Cadillac. Irene continued, "He'd been smoking marijuana, but don't pay attention to that. Shake his hand anyway." I didn't even know what marijuana was then. I reached in the car with my hand as Clyde said, "How are you, Marshal?" I replied, "Just fine, Mr. McFadder." "Well, you take care of yourself, Marshal." I responded, "Thank you, sir." That was it. I went back to Jerome Harris to wait on another customer. At this time in my life, I still keep 2 postage stamps of Clyde McFadder. He was one of the first members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's the only person on a U.S. postage stamp that I've ever shaken hands with. Clyde died sometime in the 1980s in New Jersey. Pigmeat used to stay at the Biltmore, just like all the other black entertainers who came to Durham during that time. Besides Pigmeat Markham, I and other kids observed other entertainers like Shirley and Lee, Ike and Tina Turner, and James Brown, just to name a few. Seldom did we ask for autographs, because they seemed part of the regular scene. Once someone told me, "Marshal, Malcolm X just went down the street." "So what?" I replied. I did see a glimpse of his back. I once saw a picture of Michael Jackson being surrounded by several dozen white officers. That would not have happened in Durham. Michael Jackson would have been guarded by a mixed bag of officers, or they would have all been black. Jackie Wilson always asked for John Hunter when he came to Durham. It is said that he wanted John to keep him away from alcohol so that he could perform properly on stage. James Brown is quoted as saying, "The people in Durham always treat you like a hero when you're on stage, but off stage you have to wait in line at Minnie Hester's like everyone else." Minnie Hester's was an after-hours clubhouse. For years, from the 1920s to the mid-1970s, Durham was a mainstay of the Chitlin' Circuit. No black entertainer worth his or her salt would pass up an opportunity to perform in the Bull City, as Durham is called. As mentioned before, besides all the other black businesses, the Biltmore Hotel was the only black-owned hotel between Washington, D.C. and Atlanta, Georgia, on the East Coast. Jack Mitchell, Lath Alstom, Artis Plummer, and Roosevelt Lipscomb were the dance promoters who brought these entertainers to Durham. Because of all those things Durham had going for itself, the citizens of Durham, black or white, never took a back seat to anyone. The black officers who were pioneers in the Bull City were also very proud men. With all the hardships of race, uncertainties, challenges among their own people, they endured with pride and honor. Surely there were officers among them that did not carry the standard well, but the ones that did carried the banner well for the unworthy also. I was reminded by some of the older Hayti police that not only did they have to endure personal hardships, but they were issued the used cars that had been driven already by the white commanders. The white leadership did not supply the black police officers with new cars yearly because they accused the black officers of always having dusty or muddy cars. Well now, the streets that they worked on were dusty in dry times and muddy during wet times. Even a great many white officers had dusty or muddy cars. That was the nature of the streets that the officers worked on. Of course, some of the main thoroughfares were paved, but a great many of the side streets were not. All this changed after 1969. It was in April of 1969 that the last major civil rights demonstration took place in downtown Durham. For years prior to 1969, there had been demonstrations in Durham the same as most other southern cities. The black officers were always in a quandary when one of these events occurred. The leadership would do one of two things with the black policemen. If it was thought that the demonstration would turn violent, they put the blacks on the front lines. But generally, this would be a calming effect for both sides of the lines, the demonstrators and the police. Black officers generally kept cool under fire longer. If violence was not anticipated, the black officers would generally be left on patrol duty to answer the criminal calls that continued to come in, regardless of any demonstration taking place. This sometimes gave the black officers opportunities to work all over Durham, and especially in the other black neighborhoods scattered all over the city. This worked, too, because the other citizens of Durham observed the black officers in action, which was very rarely observed except in the Hayti district. The April 1969 demonstration was led by Ben Ruffin and Howard Fuller, two very notable young civil rights activists in Durham. I knew Ben Ruffin pretty well, because when I was 12 years old and a new arrival in the West End in 1957, Ben Ruffin, who was about 4 years older, befriended me and even taught me how to play Bid Whist. He had to have a lot of patience, because, admittedly, I was slow to learn. Howard Fuller was new to me, but I was well aware of his involvement in the civil rights struggle. He didn't compromise on many issues. This demonstration was concerning equal employment opportunities in downtown Durham in the stores and shops where blacks were allowed to buy, but not work up front. And last, but very important, the demonstrators wanted all the streets in Durham paved. This embarrassing situation of unpaved streets had to end. The demonstrators, mostly young blacks, centered their activity at Five Points in downtown Durham sometime around 7:30 or 8 p.m. during this time of April 69. They had made a fire in a barrel and were singing and making speeches in and around this fire. The police, on the other hand, were in their riot gear, which included helmets and long batons. We were in a line facing east toward the crowd. I remember well that a great many of the black officers were up front in line. The helmets hid our identity to some degree. The lieutenant in charge had us standing fast for quite a while. Then the demonstrators, many of whom I knew from my growing up in Durham with them, began to chant loudly, "Oomp, Oomgawa, the black man got the powwow! Oomp, Oomgawa, the black man got the powwow!" The lieutenant couldn't stand it anymore. He gave the order to charge. We turned our batons toward the demonstrators, and they began to flee east down the city streets. You could hear windows being broken and people screaming. It was utter chaos. Several fires were being set, but not to buildings. The police seemed just as confused as the demonstrators. It was not long before I found myself in front of an entourage of Howard Fuller's right-hand people, with the 6'6" Howard Fuller leading them. They were walking calmly eastward on the sidewalk in the 100 block off East Main Street. A white officer, who had arrived on the police department when I did, came, it seemed, out of nowhere, and stood in front of Howard Fuller and his followers. He demanded of Mr. Fuller, "Get off the sidewalk!" Mr. Fuller replied, "We have a right to walk on the sidewalk." There was a moment of frightened quiet. I stepped in front of the officer and said, "They have a right to walk on the sidewalk. The sooner they go home, the sooner we go home." The Fuller contingent continued to walk, as I indicated to the other officer to let them pass. Most of the demonstrators faded into the dark back into Haiti. A curfew was imposed on the city for several days. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening. Be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.